Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and today we're talking about building community and getting a CS degree. A few years ago, Michael created People of Color in Tech.
I'm Michael Bain. I'm the co-founder of peopleofcolorintech.com and the co-host of the Techish Podcast.
It's part media company, part product, and a lot of community.
We tell and create the stories of people of color in tech. We help people find jobs, and we tell really interesting stories, media articles, podcasts, all around people of color in tech, basically.
And it was also an accident. Michael always wanted to be an entrepreneur, but when he started People of Color in Tech, or Pocket for short, he didn't intend for it to be a business. We talk about how he ended up creating a business out of his side project, how he balances serving that community with paying the bills, and why he decided to go back to school to get his master's in computer science after this. So you basically run a kind of a media company slash a community that is focused on telling the stories of people of color in tech. Why did you decide to create this?
There isn't actually any like real intellectual story behind it. I was in New York a few years ago and I met a wonderful person called Ruth, who ended up being the co-founder, and we stayed in touch, and then we were WhatsApping every now and then while I was back in London, and she kind of was like, why don't we kind of start a blog and just interview people of color in tech? And I was like, great idea. So We interviewed our friends at first, then we reached out to other people, And it just snowballed from there, really. That's pretty much why we started. We added a recruitment component much later, but that was the initial seed of the idea.
So you've been doing it for a few years now. At what point did you decide, okay, this is going to be a business, or was it always intended to be a business?
It absolutely was never intended to be a business. I actually had left my day job as a software engineer at a startup in London, and I was like, I'm going to find my real startup idea. And this was kind of like just a cool side hobby. It was one of those things where it was like, the only thing that was driving it was, wouldn't it be cool if? And that's literally how it snowballed, literally from that. So at the same time, I was working on, you know, Uber for X. I was looking for my Uber for X idea. That was the kind of hot thing at the time. Mm-hmm. People of Color in Tech was a side hobby that just eventually just snowballed. I think eventually companies started reaching out to us saying, can we collaborate with you guys for recruitment? Mm-hmm. So once we realized there was some kind of revenue model and it wasn't something that was going to kind of compromise the community, we said, let's go and see how far we can take it, really.
And it's interesting because I know a lot of people get into code and decide to level up and become more technical because they have an idea, an itch they're trying to scratch, and you know, they want to do something just for themselves, just for a side project, and want to build it themselves. So when you were initially thinking about Pocket and doing it as a side thing, and then eventually it turned into a business, where were your technical skills?
My technical skills were hidden away, actually, because the initial iteration was just a WordPress blog. Mm. We literally just started off with WordPress. It's only when we got into recruitment that I actually started to code. So I didn't write code for this company for at least a year into its fruition. And I guess there's something in that, as amazing as code is, sometimes the most important thing is validate you have something here. Mm. Is there some demand for what you're doing? Is there traction? And then write code as per necessary and not just write code for the sake of code. I know this is a code based podcast, but after about a year, I just built a really simple, basic, just HTML, non-dynamic website. And then later on, as it got more complex, I built it out using the latest JavaScript frameworks like React, which is Facebook's front end framework. What was needed at the time is what I built. I started off with no code, and then eventually now I've got quite a sophisticated product that, you know, has got a whole bunch of lines of code in there that I've tried to maintain. And you know, I just did it based on what was needed at the time. And if I didn't need the software, and if I could just use something off the shelf, then I would use that.
Were you always that disciplined? Because I feel like, you know, when I learned to code, I was thinking, ah, everything I do must have code in it. You know, like I felt this this urge to implement everything and to use the skills that I learned. I was just so proud. I was so excited by what I could do you know, I wanted everything to, you know, what's that saying? When everything's in, when you have a hammer, everything's in nail.
There we go. Right. Yeah, that's a much better phrase. Yeah. So like, I've been there with you. Like I was once that way, but I think the beauty of it was that I had such limited time for this side project that the limitations helped me. The limitation just forced me to say, what's the smallest thing that I can do that can have impact? And instead of, you know, rewriting a blog engine, let's just use WordPress. Just to get started. And it's like, cool. So limitations can actually be your friend. It's a really, you know, counterintuitive way of thinking about it, but it really did force us to kind of just do what was absolutely necessary at the time. But generally speaking, you're right. Like if I've got like a, when I first started to learn to code, I was doing everything that was not even necessary to do. There were so many things I could have got just off the shelf. I was like, no, you know, let's make our own, you know, I can do it better. Like, and it's just like, no, you really can't. But anyways, it's good for a learning exercise. And this was actually just, what can we get done in the shortest period of time? And that was it.
I really like that. That's really smart. Okay, so when you were beginning, when you first launched Pocket, it seemed like the smallest thing with the biggest impact was the WordPress site. Tell us a little bit more about that. What kinds of stuff did that blog do?
What kind of stuff did it do? Literally, it was just a blog. You could post articles, write articles. It's just a generic WordPress blog. Mm-hmm. I can't remember I think it's Theme Forest.
Theme Forest
you can just go there and like you can, the great part of doing an internet business is that you can stand on the shoulders of giants. There are so many developers that have, you know, open source code or, you know, themes that they've already built that you can just plug into your platform. And that's what the initial iteration was. Later on, I redesigned it and rejigged it to be more fitting for our purposes and our vision, but that was enough to get us started. So it was a very simple venture at first. It's just, if you've had any experience with WordPress, then you know what I'm talking about, and it's very intuitive, and it was enough for us to get started.
So you mentioned earlier that the moment you decided, okay, maybe I need to build my own thing, was when the recruitment part came in. Is that right?
So essentially what happened is we had an email newsletter, and I said, why don't we put some jobs here and just have a link saying, if you want to post your own job, get in contact with us. The jobs that I had sourced were not jobs that had been, we had not been paid to place those jobs in our newsletter, for example. I just found the best jobs that I thought were relevant for our community. And that's how it started. Essentially, sometimes you have to, you know, fill the demand, and then in order to create the demand, if that makes any sense. Once that happened, then I built a website. I was like, okay, cool, we've got something here. Someone's paid us actual real money to post the position. And I've had projects before, I couldn't get anybody to pay for anything. So I was like, whoa, this is actually something here now. So I spun out a little subdomain and just had a really simple website. And then, you know, later on, I built profiles, messaging, and it was all just bit by bit.
So when you did that, when you did the subdomain, you didn't take down your WordPress site and replace it.
No, not at all.
You just built, again, the smallest thing that you had to build to fulfill this new thing. That's awesome.
Yeah, so the WordPress site is still up there. If you go to peopleofcolorandtech.com, that's still WordPress. And we moved away from a subdomain and pushed it to pocketjobs.com to have its own separate domain. But for the longest period of time, jobs.peopleofcolorandtech.com, if you're following, was an app stored on Heroku versus the WordPress, which is on the main domain name. I mean, if it's not broken, why fix it? So I didn't see the point.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's amazing that I'm definitely not that disciplined. I wish I was, but I'm definitely not. I definitely tend to... You know,
it's all about
like,
the time constraints.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right.
It's all about the time constraints. Like, I just didn't have the time. If I had the time, I probably would have, you know, outdid myself and tried to prove how great and smart I was and probably wouldn't have got as far.
So the parts of the app that you actually built and coded yourself, how did you learn how to do those things? Is that something that you picked up along the way? Was that what you were doing at your old startup job? Where did those skills come from?
I've only ever had one job as a developer, actually. In that 1 year, I was working as like the first engineering hire under a startup based out here in London. And I worked just side by side by the CTO. And it was the biggest, you know, time of my growth really as a coder, because standing next to somebody every day who knows exactly what they're doing, has many years of experience, you can kind of just leapfrog and use their knowledge. They just teach you so much. And then they would throw things at me and say, okay, React is new, learn it and then see how you can integrate it. So I was constantly having to kind of, you know, learn these new frameworks and get my feet wet and not be afraid to learn something new that I had no, you know, competence beforehand. So once I had left, I just leveraged what I knew in that 1 year and for that 1 year as a developer. And it was all that 1 year after uni that was where everything I learned and that I've used came from, basically.
Mm. Interesting. Okay, so you've been working professionally as a developer for 1 year before you did all the Pocket stuff. When you think about the stack or the tech stack of Pocket today,
yeah.
Do you think of the company as a technical product? Do you see it as a media company? Is it a community? Like, how do you frame your business in your mind?
I don't really frame it in that sense. I just do what has to be done. Mm. And if I need to code to do something, then I do something. The end goal is, how do we serve our community? That's the end goal. Mm. And the way that we get there is the way that we get there. And if anybody from outside the company wants to kind of say, you're a media company or you're a tech company or you're a hybrid, then so be it. Mm. I almost feel like those kind of terms are kind of put on you so that you can kind of raise money. Because investors don't like media companies. They just
That's
don't.
True.
Like.
Yeah.
But in terms of how I define our the company, I tend not to. We have parts of our company that wouldn't be out of place at a tech company, and parts that wouldn't be out of place at a media company, but it's not something that I spend too much time thinking about, to be honest.
When you think about the main value of what you do of your business, you know, when I think about Kunubi, for example, we do a bunch of stuff. You know, we do have a website, we have a Rails app, we're working on a product, we have a community, we have a bunch of different parts of things, right? But the real, I guess, value of what we do is having a consistent brand message and bringing, like, calling out to people, broadcasting to people, and bringing them together under that message, you know? So in the same way, I don't really know what we are, you know? Like, we're not really media, we're not really tech, we're kind of somewhere. So when you think about the value, the one thing that really shines about Puck and about what you do, what is that thing?
The one thing I would say is that we just tell the stories of people of color in tech, and we let people know that A, you're not alone. A, the journey that you're going through is quite, you know, similar to what others have gone through. Mm-hmm. And we shine a spotlight on people that haven't necessarily been at the forefront of what people consider to be tech. You know, when I ask you, think of a technologist, you know, historically, you're not going to think of a young black woman, for example. Mm-hmm. And we try to rail against that and, you know, show there are plenty and there will be even more in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about shifting image. It's about also comforting people who are already in the industry and juggling both of those things, where you're encouraging the current generation and you're kind of helping the next generation come through, if that makes sense, through the power of storytelling.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So when you think about the future of Pocket and where you want it to grow and go and become, what does that future look like?
I just want us to do more of the same and just double down on what we're doing, really. I don't tend to plan out too far into the future. I never plan for more than, like, 6 months to a year. So I have a lot on our roadmap. Yeah, because it's like, you know, when you're a bootstrap founder, you never know. You just gotta be practical. Yeah. Let's keep it 100. Like, you just don't know what the future may hold.
We leave no idea.
Yeah, so I plan for the next year, and a lot of it is just kind of more features to help people find jobs, more features to help companies search, more features to help produce great content, expand our audience with our podcast, and that's it, really. And just more of the same. People seem to like what we're doing, so I just want to give them more and more of that, really. I'm not going to over intellectualize it and say we're going to be this in 5 years time, we're going to be 100 million, you know, profiles. It's I can't go there right now.
Yeah.
1 year max.
What's really interesting about what you're doing is that it's a little bit of everything, but it's also very much around community, or at least it's about making people feel like they're a part of a community, an existing community.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think a lot of people do who don't do it within the construct of a business, right? Like, we might organize our local meetup groups or do, you know, lunch and learns at work or, you know, go to hackathons. Like, I think in our own way, we try to either find our community or we try to organize a community for people who need it. And what I've personally found interesting over the years is that there is a pretty big difference between running a community and then also having to think about revenue.
Yeah.
You know, it's just different.
Completely.
It's very different. Completely. Yeah. And I'm wondering what was most surprising to you about that, about saying, you know, I want to do this for people of color in tech and I want to help them, but also I have to pay bills. Yeah. How do you manage that?
It's hard to explain. You kind of almost feel a bit guilty. You start thinking to yourself, am I compromising my community here by generating revenue? And, you know, that's a struggle. As much as you love your community and your community loves you, they will hold you to a very high standard, more so than your friends will hold you to a standard. So if you do anything that is, you know, compromising their trust, you will hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's like, that's a constant struggle. And we just kind of got over it slowly, and we just kind of monitor and see if there's a backlash, and we kind of try to keep everyone's best interest at heart. And that's how we operate really day by day.
Yeah, I love that, this idea that the community is not your friend, because I think I came to a similar realization pretty early on where I started Code Newbie with the intention of creating something that I needed, but by being the organizer of it, I kind of realized that frankly, I don't get to benefit from it. You know, like I don't.
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, like I'm busy taking care of people and making sure everyone else is. You're just like, you know, when you're a host of a party, like you don't really get to
That's
eat.
That's it.
You know?
Yeah, you're usually there to facilitate the fun. You're not there to have the fun.
Exactly. And, you know, if you end that party wiped out and tired and hungry, you've done a great job. You know?
Literally, right? Literally.
Yeah, so that's kind of how I feel about the Code Newbie community too, is it's kind of like, you know, I'm responsible for it, but I don't really get to partake in it the way I initially thought. So how do you manage that? How do you manage the responsibility of doing right by your people and your community and making sure, you know, you're taking care of them and you're taking that responsibility seriously, but also paying the bills? How do you balance that?
It's more of an internal dialogue, really. If it doesn't feel right, then I won't do it.
Yeah.
You know, like whenever a company wants to, you know, use our platform, they go through like an approval process so we can make sure that, you know, this is a serious company that we want to, you know, because what they do reflects badly on us, and we would hate to, you know, give them candidates and the candidates come back and say, well, I wasn't really, you know, treated correctly, or I don't think they gave me a fair shake of things, or I felt there was some kind of discrimination. You know, touch wood, that hasn't happened, but, you know, we try to make sure that that doesn't happen. And people can flag up as well if there's jobs on the platform where they're like, yeah, like this isn't really, you know, a company that, you know, thinks aligns with your values. But it's a constant battle, yeah. And it's also an internal dialogue that I have all the time, where, you know, we have people submit articles as well, so sometimes the articles I'm like, oh, I don't necessarily know if this necessarily aligns with what we believe in.
Oh, those are always so awkward.
Right, yeah. I'm, you guys, like, send an email and be like, I'm sorry fam, like this ain't the one, like we can't really host this. Like, I know a few other platforms maybe, but this isn't us.
Yeah
So I'm the judge of it, and then I find out in due course on Twitter or my email, in my inbox, if I've done something wrong or we're not going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Touch wood, thankfully, everything's been all right so far.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the revenue thing is difficult. I mean, because essentially when you have a community, essentially you charge for access to that community.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's other models of doing things, but so far that's the main way that I see it. And you always want to make sure the people that are having access to your community are, you know, stellar and are up to scratch and are not going to jeopardize your community. Mm-hmm. And that's the main, you know, struggle, really.
Absolutely. And, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about business models and, you know, revenue streams in, you know, for Code Newbie and in the context of having a community. And there's really just not that many. Like, that's the conclusion I came to. There's really just not that many, because you're either charging for access or you're charging the community. And if you're trying to serve people who, you know, who need help and need support, you don't really want to charge them, you know? So it's...
Right, yeah.
It's tough. Yeah, at the end of the day, it really is just about a judgment call.
Okay. I envy people that have like a community of just like millionaires. Yeah. They can just be like, yeah, it's a $500 subscription monthly. Like, hit me up. Yeah.
Nailed it. So one problem I guess I've seen in the world of community organizing is this expectation that you need to sacrifice everything for your community. I see this a ton, especially with people who just don't think about the sustainability part, or just don't think about the, you know, the paying the bills part of things. And I've heard so many stories of people who have gone into debt for their community, who've mortgaged their homes for their community, you know, who've like...
Are you serious?
Yes, like real financial issues, because, you know, they pay out of pocket for things, and frankly, they're not, you know, they're not really comfortable, or maybe they just haven't had a lot of success doing sponsorships, you know, whatever the reason may be, just, you know, loving and caring so much for their community that they hurt themselves, you know, very... objectively, you know, they like hurt their pockets. What are your thoughts on that? How can people who are running communities, who want to be a great community organizer and don't necessarily need to make it a business, what are some things that they can do or should think about when it comes to not burning out and making sure what they're doing is sustainable?
I recommend, you know, try to find a model that makes it sustainable, whether that's Patreon, whether that's, you know, advertisement, whether that's sponsorship, something, whether that's even like free location space, or, you know, you've got to hustle really and try to find the resources, and don't do that to yourself, because you burning out or going financially broke isn't helping anybody.
That's true.
Eventually, what you want to do will cease to exist because of just the financial realities. So you may think that you're helping, but in the end, you're not really. and your community would understand, really. Mm. If you're open and transparent with them and say, listen, we can't afford to do this right now, or we could afford this if, you know, we had donations, people will chip in, especially if it's something where, you know, it's pure art. And if they can't chip in, that's a different story. If they can't, that's fair enough. But if they won't, then I would seriously consider what you're doing. If it's an element where you're serving people that are economically deprived, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Anything else where, you know, you might be doing something for JavaScript developers or whatever, or someone who, or a group or a segment of the population that has resources but they won't chip in to help you make something happen, then yeah,
that's a red flag. Know if
it, that's a red flag. Yeah, to me, I'm trying to be really politically correct and polite, but I'll be like, yo, you got to bounce. Like, just the ones, like, stop it. Like, look after yourself and fall back until you can figure out a way to make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other component of doing community work is the emotional burden, right? Because I hear a ton of stories from people who are not really in a great place in life, in their careers, who are getting into code because they want to make a change, they want to make improvements. Mm. And, you know, it can be tough, you know, to kind of absorb people's energies and people's stories. And that's something that, you know, if you don't watch yourself, can take a toll. And I imagine you might have experienced something similar with people of color in tech, of, you know, hearing, you know, unfortunate stories or sad stories. And, you know, just kind of when you care so much about people and you want them to do well, you can end up being an emotional sponge for that too. Is that something that you've dealt with?
From time to time. You know, I'd say like maybe 20% of the emails that we get are people saying, I want to learn to code, I just can't afford what's out there. Mm-hmm. So that's always difficult. I don't necessarily always know what to say. And I wish we had some kind of mentorship component where I could, you know, do it in a scalable way, but I can't mentor everybody. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. But then the bulk of the emails that we get are people saying, you know, the content has really inspired me, or I'm going to go into tech, or I'm going to kind of consider going into tech. And those things keep me going. So thankfully, I haven't necessarily got too drained or you know, down in the dumps about the negative stories or the stories where I can't or I'm powerless to help. I do try my utmost, but I really feel for people that maybe run communities that where the bulk of the messages are, I think, going awry or things not happening in a nice manner. So I don't know, even know what to say to those people. That must be very difficult.
Coming up next, Michael tells us what it was like to go back to school to get his master's in computer science, whether or not he thought it was worth it, and how his new degree has affected his career as a developer and an entrepreneur. After this. And now it's time for Tales from the Command Line, brought to you by Red Hat. So far, we've talked about how to build community almost as an art form. We use our gut and our feelings to figure out what's best for our community. But what if we used data instead?
Well, I'm Diane Mueller. I work at Red Hat as the Director of Community Development in their Cloud Platform Group.
Diane shows us what community management looks like as a science. Here we go. So you wrote a very fascinating paper called From Art to Science, Evolution of Community Development. So I want to start by asking you, when people think about or hear the term community development, what often comes to mind?
A few years back, there was a great book that was put out by Jono Bacon called The Art of Community Management, and it became sort of like the Bible of things. And so a lot of times when people think of community managers, they think of, I always say, geeks with social skills. So people who have some technology background, but they actually get along with lots of other people. They've got a good network of people, and they're, you know, they have very good social skills. And so in the past, it tends to be something that a lot of relationship building, sort of like business development, you go out and you network with people and you try and coerce, coax them into contributing to the project you're working on and understand their needs and make sure that gets fed into the roadmaps and stuff. But it was a lot of relationship management.
So you think about community management and development a little bit differently. How do you think about it?
Well, I think open source has evolved a lot over the 20, 30 years that I've been working in computers. What we've seen now is there's a lot more corporations and larger organizations involved. A lot of enterprises depend upon it. So there's a lot of people who are paid to work on projects as opposed to academics and individuals. So those kinds of things take a better, more systematic approach in order to manage, because there's no way you can rely on your gut or an art or interpersonal relationships to really know that. That kind of tooling and systematic approach really hasn't been applied to community management for open source projects at any sort of scale. There's tools out there that other people in other parts of organizations get to use, and we use to measure things. But there's also a lot of AI and ML and data analytic tools that can be applied to things like the GitHub logs of who's contributed to projects, and when new projects get built, you know, you can watch them. And there's all kinds of log files. There's log files that you can use for the mailing list, you know, people who, you know, how frequently do people come into the mailing list? When does someone new come onto your mailing list? So, you know, you can see where people are going and when people are leaving projects, whereas before things were like by your gut or instinct to watch that stuff. You can now map out and use really some really wonderful tools to see how all of the projects are interrelated. And that's kind of the aspect that is the only way I, as an individual, have been able to scale to the phenomenal size of the ecosystem that is around the project that I work on, OpenShift and Kubernetes. And so that's when I talk about try and tease it out to be a science.
Yeah, and that's what I want to dig into a bit, because I've always thought of community development as an art. I've always thought of it as something that's very touchy-feely, that's kind of run on your instincts, that is very almost like emotionally driven to an extent. Mm-hmm. And what I found so fascinating about this paper is that you have graphs. You have, you know, actual, you have great data visualizations of what community development looks like. What are some of the specific things that you're measuring?
So there's a couple of things that I do that I think are kind of unique to this approach. And one is mapping relationships across projects. So probably what you're referring to are things like the what I call the jellyfish diagrams that have wonderful visualization of larger data points are the ones who have done lots of contributions, and you can see how they're connected across projects. So someone might be working on OpenShift, which is our distribution of Kubernetes, and they might be working on the larger Kubernetes project. And mm-hmm. then you can kind of see how these projects are interrelated. And the first thing that's really cool about this is that when I, as a community person or doing community development, want to, say, get someone to speak on my podcast about a specific topic, those people who are the larger dots in the visualizations are actually probably the mavens or the thought leaders. You know, they're doing a lot. They may not necessarily have great speaking skills, but they would be my first point to click into and drill down on to see if I know them already. If I don't, to introduce myself or to look across the relationship maps to see who I do know, who knows them, who can introduce me to them. So it's, you know, in some ways, it's business development taken to community development.
Interesting.
One of the things that I love about it is it shows me really quickly where newcomers are coming into the community and on which projects they're interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell me more about that. How are these newcomers generally entering a particular ecosystem? What can we do to make them feel welcome and make them into active contributors? Tell me about that.
So I sort of have a personal philosophy, even though I obviously talk a lot, of giving away the podium. And a couple of the things that I try and do is first, I want to flag those new entrants. I want them to rise up to the top. And if they're with an organization that's new, especially to this ecosystem, you want to make sure you welcome them and reach out to them and create spaces for them to promote whatever it is they're interested in. So whenever we flag a newcomer, we always ask them to come to one of our community briefings and share, you know, what they're working on, and get them to talk about what they're doing. So there are, like, I have some little tactics that I use to make them feel welcome to start with. And it's really kind of important because for lots of reasons, diversity being a big flag for me is that trying to get different voices to give that feedback to the core contributors, the people who are working on the project already, so they can hear these new voices. And so that people see themselves in the room. I think that's a real big aspect.
Yeah, it's a big one.
This and you know, the visualizations that I have that I show really don't show diversity of culture or race or gender or anything else like that yet. But the people that I'm working with, Biturgia, have done some really interesting work to do that. And so that's one of the things that I'm very interested in too, is trying to figure out how we make sure everybody gets seen in the room and welcome to the space. And so that's really important for me with newcomers.
What can those of us who are managing communities outside of Kubernetes, outside of OpenShift, who are maybe doing it for nonprofits or startups or big companies, what lessons can we take from the paper that you wrote? What have you learned? What are some things that we can do to make our communities bigger and stronger?
So the way that I always approach it, especially with new community managers and people who are trying to grow maybe stagnant communities, is to take a step back and look at what are their sources of information. We do this a lot for other projects and other things we're working on. We don't often do it on ourselves. And so looking at the GitHub logs, looking at the mailing list, looking at who's come to your events, who are the thought leaders, to really spend some time first and identify the cast of characters, the known ones. You know, you don't need fancy software to do it. You can do this by looking at your conferences, who's coming to your meetups, and aggregate them, put them in a Google spreadsheet, start tracking them and reaching out to them. Because for most people, they think, oh, I don't have anyone contributing to my open source project, or I don't have enough people. But when you expand your worldview of who is your community, who is in your ecosystem from not just the code contributors, you begin to realize how big the space is already and who you can invite to come to take that podium, to share their stories and give feedback to the people who are already contributing. And the very interesting side effect of that, just that, no tooling, just the fact of looking at that and starting to track that in a very systematic way over time, it grew the OpenShift community. When I started 4 years ago doing this kind of approach, we had about 10 external to Red Hat communities that were contributing directly to OpenShift itself. And then when we pivoted and became embedded with the Kubernetes community, over that time period, we have over 70 people, organizations rather, that are contributing, have contributed to OKD, which is our open source project, the name of it. And that was all done without coercion or coaxing or anything. That was just by opening up our view of what the community was, and then create programs for engagement. By giving away the podium, you're doing this, you're also creating content, just, you know, podcasts and special interest groups and blog posts and all these people now. And that just starts getting that momentum that builds real engagement for communities.
And now back to the interview. Okay, so I want to switch gears a bit and talk a little bit more about how you got into code. So when you first decided, or first even heard, hey, coding might be this thing that I might want to do, where were you in your life?
I was doing my undergraduate degree, so I was studying for a business with law degree. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I always wanted to be an entrepreneur from the age of like 16, 17. It was always what I wanted to do. I wanted the whole cliche thing. I want the freedom. I want, you know, to be able to call the shots. I don't want to be told what to do. The normal, you know, stuff that you hear. You know, this is around the time of The Social Network that came out, or that film, and that basically the cultural zeitgeist was the only way for a young person to be an entrepreneur and have any real success was to be in tech. So I thought, let me do my own like startup. And I thought it'd be easy. I'd find some developers, I'd pay them. And I realized that paying developers is really expensive, especially as if you're a student. So I was kind of like, how hard could this be? I can try this myself. And I went on Amazon and bought like a HTML, CSS, JavaScript for Dummies book.
Oh, neat.
And that's how I did it. I just took a stab at it. And, you know, the startup crashed and burned. Nothing ever went anywhere, but like the skill sets kind of remained. And it lay dormant for a while because I graduated and I didn't go into a technical career. But when I went back to do my computer science master's, that was the main inspiration. I had the platform of like, okay, I know roughly how to code. I know roughly how to build something. Let me try and formalize this process. I probably could have gone on straight away and had a job as a developer, but I kind of had imposter syndrome, which is something that you kind of hear a lot. Like, it's very common, but I was like, wow, if I don't have a computer science degree, no one's going to take me seriously. Like, I can't be an engineer without one. So I went in and applied for a computer science degree, master. And the funny thing is, once I got in there, I was like, this was probably actually wasn't necessary. Like, what they taught me.
Interesting.
Yeah, what they taught me was helpful, but not necessary, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
You learn a lot of like theoretical CS stuff that I had necessarily not. For what I wanted to be, I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And the concepts that I was learning, while helpful and while intellectually stimulating, they weren't what I needed at the time.
Yeah.
It was enjoyable. I met a lot of cool people, don't get me wrong. And I can always say, listen, I've got this qualification, but it stemmed from my imposter syndrome. It wasn't necessarily something that I would recommend to people
that
coming up in my position.
Yeah. So wait, what were you doing right after your degree?
So I was trying to make another startup work. It was kind of like an e-commerce business. It never went anywhere.
And so you then were looking for yourself back at that point?
I mean, working for myself is a very like fancy way of putting it. I had like a retail job. Like I went back to retail.
Okay.
Like, I was working. Yeah. This is like real struggle time. I went back to retail. Yeah. That business didn't succeed. That was a quite a low point. And that's kind of when I was like, okay, let me go and go do my master's degree and just like hit refresh.
So at that point, when you were doing the retail job and you were doing, you know, days, weeknights, weekends on the business, and then you decided to go back and get your master's, did you feel like the reason why the business didn't succeed was because you didn't have your master's in computer science?
Yeah, I guess so. It wasn't because I didn't have a master's. It's just because I wasn't as good of a coder as I needed to be. And I took the master's as an intermediate step between, I wanted to go get a job as an engineer, essentially, so I could learn and work in a startup and learn how it's meant to be done. So I took the master's degree as the intermediate step. I could have skipped the intermediate step and found a startup that was willing to hire, you know, someone who was young, hungry and cheap, essentially. But I didn't apply because I didn't even think I was worthy of applying. Knowing what I know now, I know that wasn't true. I could have just built some side projects, you know, pushed stuff to GitHub, showed that I was learning. I didn't know what was possible, if that makes any sense. So I thought, this is what I have to do. And every example that I saw of a tech founder, they seemed to either be a dropout, like a Harvard CS dropout, or they completed it. So I was like, wow, there must be some magic in that. Let me go do that. And there wasn't. Most of the people that were there weren't great coders. They weren't great coders when they left. They wanted to work in finance. They weren't really interested in entrepreneurship. I was the only one that kind of really wanted to build those kind of things that maybe had some kind of commercial application or could be really cool and get a whole bunch of users. So I kind of walked away thinking, wow, that was really fun, but probably not what I needed necessarily. Managed to go work in a startup for about a year and a bit. And then after that year, that's how I did Pocket, which is the whole timeline, essentially.
Yeah.
I think I've just finally explained it.
So when you were doing the master's program, even though it was just a year, was there any point where you thought, maybe this isn't actually that useful?
I think I was just like in some really like arcane CS theory class where we were learning about like architecture and hardware, and I was like, damn, this is not what I need. I don't want to be learning this right now. This is not what is stimulating me at all. And you know, learning for the sake of learning is amazing, and maybe if I had done it for undergraduate when I didn't necessarily know, you know, what I was after specifically, I would have been more patient to it. But at the time I was like, wow, this isn't necessarily what I need or even that relevant. And the people that are excelling at this part of the course can't even program that well, especially once I got into a full-time role as a developer. And I realized I never needed any of it. Yeah. And I think people that don't have a CS theory will think there's some kind of magical thing that's happening that happens when you're there. And it's like, no, trust me. Like, you did a boot camp, right?
Yeah.
I think a boot camp that was like, you know, for a year would be much better than what I did.
If
that makes sense. I won't compare a 12-week boot camp to a computer science degree for 1 year. But in terms of like the way a boot camp is structured.
Yeah.
Where it's just focused on what does the industry need right now.
Yeah.
Okay, Ruby and Rails is the hot new thing. Or React. Yeah, it's very applicable. It's very just like applicable straight away in the field. Let's go. But yeah.
Did it cure your imposter syndrome?
You know what? I might contradict myself. It did actually.
It did.
So maybe that is the one. Yes. So maybe that was the win.
Worth
the buying price.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once I had the degree from the top institution, not necessarily just the computer science one, I was like, I could walk with confidence and be like, okay, cool. I'm capable.
So when you graduated and you kind of realized, you know, I don't actually need what I learned, but I feel good about myself, right? I got my degree, I got my master's, my mom's probably happy. You know, I have my CS degree. Did having that paper, that degree, did it help open up new opportunities for you that you don't think you would have had without it.
So the job that I got straight away after uni, I got, you know, the CEO slid into my LinkedIn DM, you know, we're looking for engineers. I'd have to ask him if he looked at my profile and saw the university and saw my CS degree and thought, let me hire this guy. Maybe it was a factor. It probably was. In the UK, because we have such kind of a class-based society, the fact that I went to an institution that is quite reputable, maybe that does have an impact in terms of some of the doors that I can walk through now.
Well, I'm really glad, selfishly, I'm really glad to hear that you could have done everything that you've done even without your CS degree, because I don't have a CS degree, so it makes me feel a little bit better. But, you know, I know there are tons of people who are asking themselves that same question, you know, should I go back to school, whether it's undergrad, whether it's to get an entirely new degree, get a master's in computer science. There's always this question in our community of, should I do it? Is it worth it? It sounds like for you, maybe it's a little bit of a mix, but if for people listening who are debating that and trying to figure out what's the best course of action for them, what are some things that they should ask themselves or consider when making that decision?
So these are things that people did that I didn't do. So when I graduated, I got a lot of LinkedIn DMs from people that were considering doing the course. And they were like, yo, like, what's it saying? Like, is it any good? Is it worth it? And I gave them my honest and, you know, true opinion. Some went and did it, some didn't. So that's one thing. Like, if you're if you've got like, a specific thing that you're eyeing up, message people that did it and say, is it worth it? Has it helped you? So that's one really beautiful hack. And people are really helpful. That's the thing, you know. We all grew up being told don't talk to internet strangers on the internet. But like, strangers on the internet can really save your life.
Yes,
like,
yes.
So definitely do that. Yeah, definitely do that. Anything else? What else would I recommend? Look at the syllabus also. Look at the syllabus on each course. Most universities will show you the syllabus also. And just have a look through. Yeah. And yeah, there's a woman called Jessica. Actually, I've forgotten her surname. She works on Netflix. I interviewed her for peopleofcolorandtech.com. And she couldn't afford a bootcamp. So what she did is, and I love this, she just looked at the syllabus and she just studied it independently. She looked at the structure of the syllabus and was like, okay, so on this day, on this week, they're doing this, then they do that, then they do that. Therefore, I need to study in that logical order. It probably would make sense to do it that way. So there's all kinds of workarounds. But definitely, number one, look at the syllabus. Number two, talk to people that have done it before. And yeah, talk to as many people as you can. There's no, you know, going back to my experience, that's all it was in my experience. I'm not going to give anybody the hard and fast answer and say, you should do this, you should do that. Listen to what I'm saying and learn from it. But your thing might be completely different. What you want to do, you might not want to be an entrepreneur. You might want to, you know, work at Google or Facebook. So that's a whole different paradigm. Yep. That's something that I don't know. So, and as I've got older, I've been comfortable just saying, I don't know. Like, nothing is clear cut or cut and dry. Everything is a trade-off. So speak to as many people as you can. Know what you want out of it specifically. Did those people get what they wanted out of it? Are they similar? Do they align? What's the syllabus saying? What's the instructor saying? All of that stuff. I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, that is very helpful. Yeah, those are really great things to think about. And especially the talking to other people. People are really open to talking to you. You know, whether it's DMs, emails, even just public tweets. People DM me all the time. I do my best to get back to everyone. But yeah, I wrote a blog post. Also, I'll put a link in the show notes about my own bootcamp experience and what was great, what was not so great, what I learned. And yeah, ask a lot of questions, figure out, you know, does this apply to my situation? And hopefully that'll help you make a good decision.
Yeah, actually, you know what? The reaching out to people, just one last point on it. Whatever you do, though, don't say, can you mentor me? Like, that's we had a whole episode dedicated to the kind of etiquette of like approaching people. And you're probably better off not using the M word, because as soon as you hear mentor, you think time consuming and it's long. I don't have time for this. If you're going to email somebody or DM them, keep it short, keep it concise. Just be like, hey, I noticed that you did this. Whatever your request is, keep it 2-3 lines max. Because I don't send like life story. You know, I know to all of us, our life story is really important. But to that person, they have their own things.
They have
that
their own life
through.
Story.
So, right. Yeah. And if there's somebody who is where you want to be, they're obviously somebody who's doing things. So like, just keep it short and concise.
Wonderful. So when you think about the future of Pocket and where you want to be as an entrepreneur, as a tech person, do you feel like even though that CS degree didn't really help, you know, maybe in that first year or even right now, do you feel like there's a point where maybe it'll be valuable, or do you feel like either way you'd probably end up in the same place?
I don't want to get caught in a dichotomy where I say it had no value. That's not true whatsoever. It had value. Like, there was definitely things that I learned, and I met great people, and, you know, I got a dedicated portion of time to study. I would just say that it was basically oversold as the one panacea to my ills. It wasn't the one thing. So I don't want to hear come and be like, oh, it's all rubbish. No, it was, parts of it were great. It just wasn't what I thought it would, you know, it would be in its totality. Mm-hmm. Who knows, maybe one day I might have to pitch to a VC and they might be like, oh, you know, my son went to that school as well. Maybe that might happen.
Yeah.
There we go. Like, you never know. Like, that might be it.
Yeah.
But that's all I could think of off the top of the head, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I think that's fair for most programs, whether it's a boot camp, an entire degree, even, you know, online courses. It's all about managing those expectations, going in and thinking, okay, I'm going to do this one thing and it's going to solve all my problems and I'm going to know everything, versus saying, okay, it'll help me in these ways, but maybe not so much in others. So yeah, I think that's where that research and looking at the curriculum and asking people, I think that's where that comes in, knowing what you'll actually get out of it if you decide to move forward. Yeah. I'm curious, for the people in your class that you said, you know, didn't really know how to code very much, what ended up happening to them?
I don't even know, you know. To be honest, a lot of them went to work in finance. So
as developers?
They didn't go into, like, I don't think they went in as developers. Okay. I think they went in as people, as people that are technically capable. Mm. I don't know if that's what's the terminology. Someone who is not in a technical role, mm-hmm. but they have an understanding of tech, basically. And I'm sure they're making oodles of money. Yeah. Like, shout out to them. Like, that's amazing. Like, I always say to people, like, even if you learn to code, it doesn't mean you have to be a coder as well.
Yes,
you can be a product manager. Yep. You can be, like, you know, people that I graduated with. There's so many, you know, you can be a growth hacker. So many things that you can do. You can be someone who is, you know, a marketer but has, you know, a technical mindset and can see, like, what APIs to use and can kind of throw stuff together and then let the engineers handle it. So whatever, you know, career you want to go into, it's not going to be helpful, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's going to be helpful regardless. Coding is an end to it. It's not an end to itself. It's a means to get somewhere, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, with this show, we focus almost exclusively on coders and, you know, people who where their primary job is being technical in some degree. But I completely agree that there's very far you can go with not that many technical skills. You know, you can learn just a little bit and use that to, you know, get a bump in your existing job, you know, bump in salary, to, you know, transition into, as you said, like a almost like a tech adjacent type of role. You know, there's a lot you can 100%. Do with just a little bit of coding skills, even if you don't go as far as to become a developer.
Absolutely. I got a great example, actually. So I got a really close homie of mine, and for a little while I was kind of helping him learn to code, just for a little bit. He was interested and he was curious, and at the time he worked in the charity sector, and he hated it. So he was like, I want to work in, you know, something in the non-profit sector, in the for-profit sector. I want to work in sales maybe, or something like that. And he ended up getting a job in cybersecurity, and when he did the interview, they had never met a salesperson who had as much understanding of tech as anybody. Yeah, because he was literally just like, oh, he was like, so does your software, like, do stuff with this API, or, you know, does it handle NoSQL databases, which is a form of database that's not, you know, the SQL type database? And he said their jaws dropped. They said, you get salespeople in here who are just like, you know, a bit of talk.
Yeah.
They might have sold other products. They don't know anything about tech. Mm-hmm. And it's enabled him to be an amazing salesperson, because now he understands the product. He can talk to the architects in the companies that he's trying to sell into, and they can have a conversation. It might be a surface level one, but it's a conversation. And now he's making big money. So, like,
that's awesome. Yeah.
Dinner's always on him whenever I go out of him, because I'm like, yes, yeah, I told you. Like, there we go.
Yeah, exactly. It'll give you an edge in the job that you may already be applying for. That's awesome. Oh, that's a great example. So next, let's move on to some fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's go.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is...
This is a different homie who I care for very deeply, but after I graduated uni, he said, go do a master's degree. And I was like, in what? In anything. It doesn't make a difference. And I was are you serious? He was like, yeah, trust me, like, they love master's degrees. Employers love master's degrees. I was like, are you sure? He was like, yeah. I didn't listen to him, but that was the worst piece of advice I ever got, because even though I did a master's degree later on, there was a logical conclusion for me to do that master's degree. I wasn't looking to go and get a degree in philosophy. No shade to anybody with a master's degree in philosophy, but it's just like that kind of investment and time with no real, you know, end product, I would have really hated it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my mom has said similar things where she's like, just get a degree. It'll be great. And I'm like,
That's the African mom. Yep, I kind of know about that one. Yeah.
She gets a pass on that one.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
Number two, my first coding project was about...
You know, I can't remember the first one, but my first memorable one was a website that might still be up. It was called feelingslikedrake.com. This is at the time when there was a lot of memes about how sensitive Drake was. Yeah. It's kind of politically incorrect. There's nothing wrong with being sensitive.
Nothing
but
wrong.
At the time, there was a lot of memes saying, you know, how sensitive is Drake? So it would be a simple questionnaire. It would ask you like 5 questions and then you'd be graded on a scale from 0 to Drake, basically. And you would get like, if it was like 75% Drake, you'd get like, yeah, you'd get like 7 Drake heads. You'd see like his face. Like, so it was just,
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it might still be up. I don't know. Yeah, I don't want to offend anybody, but it's like, there's nothing wrong with being sensitive, but it was a pretty funny thing.
That's
at the
really
time.
Funny. That is very funny. I appreciate that.
Feelingslikedrake.com.
Feelingslikedrake.com. Awesome. Okay, done. Number 3. One thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
I wish that I knew that learning to code is like learning any skill. It's like learning an instrument. You don't go to bed a bad programmer or wake up a great programmer. It's like an everyday process that you have to kind of just, you know, invest an hour a day, 2 hours a day, however many hours you can. And one day you look back and say, look how far I've come. But there isn't one specific moment where you're like, now I'm amazing. It's just like anything. Trust the process. That's all you got to do. Trust the process. Put the time in, put your head down, do the work. And anybody really is capable of learning to code, at least at a cursory level and even to a greater level.
Yes. Oh, that's amazing advice. That's amazing advice. It's a great thing to keep in mind. There are moments when I code and I'm like, that was easier than the first time, you know? But that's really, I think, the closest I've come to feeling like, oh, I'm amazing. Like the closest is that did not hurt as much, you know? But you really don't wake up, you know, a brand new code. And I think it's, you know, that reality is maybe a little bit hard to internalize because I feel like you spend so much time feeling stupid or inadequate until, you know, it's like the removal of pain is the win. And that feels like not a win.
Yeah, it's very counterintuitive because you will feel really stupid for a long period of time and you'll be like, why doesn't this work? Why doesn't this work? Why doesn't this work? You literally have to push through. Like, I swear to you, everybody goes through that. The worst meme out there is the idea of the kid that's been coding since the age of 13.
Yeah.
And that really did put me off because I was like, wow, like that's what you've got to be because that's what Mark Zuckerberg did. And I'm 20, at the time I was 20, maybe 1, 2, 3. And I thought I was Asian. I was like, yo, I'm done. Like, I don't have the capabilities to learn it. So trust the process. You're not too old.
Yeah.
And just keep going.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for sharing your journey and how you got into coding and how you got that CS degree and how you're building Pocket. You want to say goodbye?
Yeah, thanks everybody. Yeah, so everybody check out peopleofcolorandtech.com. We've got great stories. If you're looking for work or a new exciting chapter at a tech company, check us out as well. And have a listen to the Techish podcast. It's with me and Abadesi. She's amazing. She's my co-host. And we kind of bring a fresh new perspective to the tech game.
Absolutely. And we'll have all those links in the show notes as well. Thank you so much.
No worries. Ciao.
And that's the end of the episode. Let me know what you think. Tweet me at CodeNewbies or send me an email, hello@codenewbie.org. For more info on the podcast, check out www.codenewbie.org/podcast. And join us for our weekly Twitter chats. We've got our Wednesday chats at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and our weekly coding check-in every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for listening. See you next week.